Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, and we come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health and the environment. Some earth scientists are arguing for a new era in Earth's history that may persist over geological timescales, and they're calling it the Anthropocene biosphere. This is referring to the vast influence humans have had on the planet's species and ecologies. They are proposing that unless significant changes occur, melding the biosphere with what they call the technosphere, that mass extinctions will occur. In other words, the climate is changing, it's our fault, and technology is going to save us. People in the third world might be thinking, our fault? What do you mean we, white man? I'm thinking, who decides? We are awash in devastating ecological disasters and policies that I never chose. How about you? Today, we will unpack the Anthropocene theory, what the media is reporting about it, and what critics are saying. So I'm joined by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, who is, as you know, a political economist with a doctorate. So he knows more than we do. Because he has
Fireside Theater.
It's science, yeah, that's Fireside Theater. So let's, we sort of flipped a coin. Why don't we have you start sort of unpacking this paper? There's these two papers that came directly from the Anthropocene Review. So there's already a review.
It's already a scholarly, there is a scholarly journal that covers this issue. And let me just, at the 30,000-foot level, summarize what, actually, since the folks who listen to the show are well-informed, and this has been in the wind for quite some time, are probably aware of this concept. And what it focuses our attention is not only the concept of the Anthropocene, but a link that's been made to another topic that, again, I'm sure you in the audience have already heard of, which is the sixth mass extinction. And those two are now being linked, in particular this article in the Anthropocene Review, the Anthropocene Biosphere, by a slew of people led by Mark Williams from Leicester University in the UK.
The other people, it's a combination of people from the US.
Well, there's people from the UK and a collection of people from the US. And I have this article linked on our site so you can get your hands on it. But the Anthropocene is a concept that really got launched a little over a decade ago by, he's not one of the co-authors, but he's one of the leading lights in this idea, which says not just that human beings have a significant effect on the Earth, and in particular it's the biosphere, but that human beings have had such an impact that their influence constitutes a new epoch in the Earth's history. And the folks in this particular article argue that it is comparable to the transition from unicellular to multicellular organisms 650 million years ago. Quite grand in terms of theory. The idea has been popularized, as, again, many of you may know, by the recent book by Diane Ackerman called The Human Factor. The Human Factor?
While you're talking, I'll look it up.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I've forgotten the name of that.
The Human Age.
The
World Shaped by Us by Diane Ackerman.
The world shaped by us. So this is more than the concept here subsumes climate change kinds of discussions of since industrializations, humans had this effect and that effect, but actually extends to affecting the geologic record. So this is a grand theory on a grand scale. In the course of the article, these authors make the link between the human effect on the planet as a whole, the planet's history as a whole, and what is now being called the sixth extinction, what is being anticipated as something even more catastrophic than the end of the dinosaurs, when a 6 mile wide asteroid hit the Yucatan Peninsula and gave us a huge amount of change and wiped out something like 50% of the species on Earth and ushered in the age of mammals. So this is the argument that these folks, these earth scientists make, is that there are four things at work that human beings do, which profoundly affect the way in which biological systems work. The first of those is what they call the spread of neobiota, which means new biologies. And elsewhere it's been referred to as the rise of invasive species as a result of the spread of human activity. Yes.
They have it described as global homogenization. In other words, that everything's going to be the same. That's what I interpreted that as meaning.
They interpret that, that's how they interpret it, and that finds its way into the article in The Guardian that kind of highlights this paper. And what they mean by homogenization is that species get distributed everywhere, that there are no isolated, there are no bioregions. There cease to be bioregions. And that has a profound effect. And they use what should be familiar examples of this phenomenon, such as the spread of domestic felines and the spread of brown rats and so on. And then there are, plant species that are spread by human activity.
Oh, I was just going to go on to the second one, which
yes,
is...
Yes, I know.
You want to do that?
I can.
So the second one is that a single species, which is us, Homo sapiens, command 25 to 40% of net primary production and also mining fossil net primary production, fossil fuels, to break through the photosynthetic energy barrier. You want to translate that? It doesn't seem, and also would.
Okay.
Yeah.
Biological entities can be divided into what are called trophic levels. So forget about that word trophic. Just think about when we look at organisms, you can divide them up into levels of what they eat. So primary producers turn sunlight into their flesh. So plankton and so on turn that in. And at the highest level, you have top predators like polar bears and lions and tigers, oh my. When these authors say that 25 to 40% of primary production is being dominated by human activity, they aren't saying that we are eating 25 to 40% of primary production. What they are saying is that our activities affect 25 to 40% of primary production, since human beings as omnivores land somewhere in the middle, somewhere at the level of wild pigs, in terms of how they affect their food consumptions affect primary producers. But in order to do that, we are turning something like 60% of the surface area, the dry land surface area, into agriculture of one kind or another, or into cities of one kind or
another.
And mostly
cities.
Well, in terms of just surface area, it's mostly agriculture.
One of the articles specifically says that we've paved over a lot of the productive land.
But not huge. Anyway, that's part of the picture. So it isn't just about what we eat. It's about what we have taken out of primary production and put to our own uses.
Yeah, all this mining and stuff. And you know, it's interesting because even on to the next one, which is human-directed evolution of other species, we know about that. So we're domesticating things, and here
they mean not just this goes back to the domestic to 10,000 years, beginning 12,000 years, beginning of agriculture. Of we've been modifying or involved in modifying other species.
Well, domestication.
For a very long time, mm-hmm. and only more recently the more scary prospect of fiddling around with the mechanics of heredity.
Well, that's been actually going on for a while because domestic animals, like turkeys are a good example, are nothing like their wild counterparts. So, you know, there's been some of that going on, but they're promising to do things that are even more.
Well, when they're fiddling around with genomes as opposed to simply using.
Right, characteristics.
Breeding mm-hmm. Techniques. Mm-hmm. So that's the third.
And you know what?
Effect.
So up until here, I'm like going, okay, yeah, that's really true. And when you read the article and you're reading it, you go, yeah, we are doing that, and that is a problem, and that's all real. And then they get to this fourth point, and then I start going, uh-oh.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay, so the fourth one is, and this is a slippery slope, increasing interaction of the biosphere with the technosphere. So remembering that they discuss the fact that technology is making fire. I mean, it's using stone tools. We've been doing technology for a while. But they're actually saying interaction of the biosphere with the technosphere, and then in parens they say, I'm quoting here, the global emergent system that includes humans, technological artifacts, and associated social and technological networks. These unique features of today's biosphere may herald a new era in the planet's history that could persist over geological timescales. Well, part of it is they're saying, uh-oh, and then part of it, when you actually read their paper, is about technology is going to save us.
Their argument in terms of the technosphere, which is a concept that's been around for quite a while, is the idea that the product of human ingenuity becomes an entity in itself. And one of the things that they discuss in this article is that the state of the technosphere, that all the artifacts of human ingenuity that affect humans as well as other living things, are all of those artifacts are still dependent on human activity. Humans are still have to intervene, so that if humans disappeared, the technosphere would soon disappear. But they anticipate in terms of how, and when we say technosphere, we're not just talking about machines, we're talking about all the things that support the machines. So the technosphere includes ships at sea, airplanes in the air, highways that take us places, communications systems, You name it. It's not just what you're carrying around in your pocket. And don't forget that agriculture itself is a technology.
Now especially,
In fact, there is a new form of agriculture that's being developed. It's called smart agriculture, which is the integration of a wide variety of technologies blended and worked together. But nevertheless, they point out that at this stage of the technosphere, it's not self-sustaining, but the direction in which it's going is that it is self-sustaining in a way that the biosphere is. So that in a way that is, they are arguing that either we have to get that thing integrated with the living system of the Earth, or all is doomed.
Right. The problem I have here is that, incidentally, it was their article where I found this. Statistics are tricky, so you have to kind of read them and go, well, based on... But one of the quotes here is quoting, on a global scale, an analysis of satellite imagery has shown that only one quarter of the Earth's ice-free land surface is still wilderness. It isn't just a question of how much land is left for agriculture, but we're also cutting forests down and all that kind of stuff. The problem I have with them is that, and I mark these areas, is that they don't seem to be saying necessarily that technology has to be based on a precautionary principle. They're just saying, well, we can enhance things with technology. I should mention that you're listening to your own health and fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett's here with me, and we're discussing this, among other things, this article called The Anthropocene Biosphere that was written by 6 geologists and scientists, published in the Anthropocene Review, and it's been causing a lot of ripple effect in the media and in authors and, in fact, in some critics of this theory. It's obvious from the name that it means that we have so changed the world that we should have an epic named after us. And it implies that they're saying that technology will pull it out. And they, in my experience of reading this article, they're not using a kind of cautionary quality to this. They're saying the widespread infusion of biology into technology and vice versa represent another unique characteristic of the Anthropocene. Hooray for humans. And the technosphere is intricately linked into the biosphere, in effect parasitizing it, but with the potential to become commensural. So they go on to say the speed of technology's evolution as expressed in techno-fossil change is now several orders of magnitude more rapid than that of biological change, even during the Cambrian explosion, which is the meteorite, right? Yeah. And is accelerating, so the technological advance. So the speed of evolution reflects the fundamentally different nature of evolution of technology and culture with respect to biological evolution. Technology and cultural chains can be transmitted, etc. So we're importing and exporting a whole bunch of changes, and one of the technosphere, the success of the technosphere has enabled a geographically unprecedentedly high population of a single terrestrial vertebrate species, which is us. So it's helped us, not helped the rest of the planet, and yet. My impression of this article is that they are pushing for more technology. It gets tricky because they're also saying the growth of large-scale social movements that act to diminish the impact of such adverse global forcings could represent the emergence in the technosphere of a kind of global thermostat. So they are suggesting that social movements will make a difference.
To give a concrete example here, one of the things they mention as a possible response in the technosphere to the anthropogenic changes that could cause a sixth extinction, since they're not advocating a sixth extinction. They're just saying the effect of humans is such that it could cause the loss of up to 75% of the species on the face of the planet. But one of these integrated concepts that they discuss is agroecology.
Yeah, they
are arguing that a problem that is a characteristic is that we're overreaching in terms of how we actually do exploit natural systems. Agroecology is a technology that works to sensibly integrate agricultural practices into ecological systems.
We hope so.
So they're not, in one respect, they are not hearkening back to 19th century concepts of humans being the masters of the world. But in another sense, they are reflecting that ideology of we are the dominant species. And there are some other 19th century aspects that we'll discuss in a minute to their conception, to this ideology of both the Anthropocene and the sixth extinction.
I just want to get this last thing off my chest, because they do also suggest that, well, we just, because this is so, we're in such desperate straits that emergency measures such as geoengineering to lower mean global surface temperature may be necessary. And then they have this commensal relationship producing a techno-biosphere where the two are virtually inseparable, but sustainable and co-evolve rather than the present situation. So it sounds like, on the one hand, you know, these guys have a certain well-meaning kind of quality. I mean, there isn't, they are identifying problems, but there's, for me, my opinion, an intolerable sense of hubris here, and they are missing a point that we're very concerned about, which we'll get to as we go through this process.
I'm not sure that they're quite as insensitive as you think they are.
Well, I don't think they're evil.
They're
scientists.
I think that they are concerned about, deeply concerned about these issues, that they're doing good science. I'm not sure that they're right, but they are doing good science, and they are conscientious about what they're doing. One of the interesting things at the end of the article that they contrast is that the rise of the Anthropocene that they've discussed in the preceding pages, if something catastrophic happens with human beings because of the state of the technosphere, that the effects will carry on, but not nearly so greatly as they are discussing. And they're talking about something catastrophic in the range of 100, 200 years. What we're going to have to find is a way to integrate these things. Otherwise, there is going to be an even bigger catastrophe once the technosphere kind of gets its legs and takes off. Now, one of the issues here that is of concern to us is kind of a two-part concern. One is, how is this information being interpreted in the media? One of the sets of people who have analyze this and worried about it are the geologists who actually go about the business of figuring out when do different geologic ages begin and end. And one group of these folks wrote an article which kind of captures this, which is the Anthropocene, an issue of stratigraphy, which is that science of geologic strata. Or is the Anthropocene an issue of stratigraphy or pop culture?
Right.
So how is this capturing our imagination and what happened, and more importantly, how is that imagination being guided into specific actions rather than others?
Yeah, they even say at the end of their brief critique, which also sounds a little bit like, "Hey, you guys, you're kind of jumping ahead of the game here. Wait a minute." So they say toward the end of the article, is this a market catchphrase that produces questionable labels? And they also say, could there be a clever endgame in mind? So they're questioning both the way they're going about suddenly changing the, you know, sort of sending us on from the Holocene into an Anthropocene. And these guys are usually the ones that are involved in that decision, so there's that. But then they're saying, why are you guys doing this? As if they think there might be something going
I'm
going
to do a slight aside here, and I'll make it short, which is that one of the things that I haven't seen mentioned here is, why is all this being churned up? And a good deal of it has to do with not money, but careers, that you make your way in academia by having a big idea and promoting it and being known for it. Now, I don't think these are bad people, but they have careers to be concerned with.
So anyway, so this stuff has gotten picked up by the media, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, how humans are driving the sixth mass extinction. Although, when you read it, you go, oh!
That's exactly.
Guardian?
This is from the Guardian. And one thing, again, a slight aside, they get some of the concepts wrong, or wrong, misconceived, inaccurate, which bothers me. But The effect is boogie, 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 boogie. Here's something else to be frightened about. And the effect of that, I think, is captured by, there's a book out now called, it is called The Sixth Extinction.
Yeah.
And it was reviewed in the
Elizabeth
Colbert. And it was reviewed in the New York Times by Al Gore.
Wait. I just want to say that since we just went quickly over this thing, this article by Jeremy, I should be wearing stronger glasses. Jeremy Nance. At the end, when he says, "What do we do about this?" he is saying that one of the people that he interviewed agrees that humans must move on from the view that we're somehow separate from nature. You know, which is, and that. That we think of ourselves as stewards instead of that we shape everything. So, you know, it's a call. He's calling to us to think better about things, but it does have that effect of scaring you.
But note that it is, as one of the reviews of Diane Ackerman's book, The Human... What was that? About the Anthropocene.
The human age.
Is that one of the issues that's raised by examining her book is what this reviewer calls the Tonto effect, which Lena alluded to.
Yeah,
we. And the writing about this in both the technical article, the Anthropocene biosphere, and the Guardian article that covers the same issue, talks about we humans do this, that, and the other. And one of the things we're going to take a look at is, what you mean we?
Well, it reminds me of my criticism of the book Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, Men Are From, I don't know which order it was in, and it talks about these tendencies that men and women have, and I'm thinking, so can people not look into doing some therapy or reading some books and like examining some other possible behaviors and having so this article that you took that quote from was by John Christensen, and this is from the San Francisco Chronicle, and mentioning that we are not in the same boat, and ends with, "I just hope other writers take the human age as a kick in the pants to finish the books we really need to see our way clearly, that we really need to see our way clearly through the Anthropocene." that takes us to a little musical break. So this is Your Own Health and Fitness, Lena Berman, Jeff Fawcett, having at on the issue of a new epoch called the Anthropocene Biosphere, and what do we think about all the churn that's being produced around this and the paper itself. We're going to take a brief music break, and when we come back, we'll continue this discussion about the Anthropocene. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to a critique by me, Lena Berman, and Jeff Fawcett of the Anthropocene theory. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier extended access to our over 600 archive shows with our library card feature. Get a free stream of this week's show, and we'll post any information there that we mention, any links or anything, and it's all at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, as always. And if you want to reach us, please do that at admin, A-D-M-I-N, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. So there's another mention, another review of Ackerman's book. And the reason Ackerman is interesting to me is that she historically is someone who writes about the natural world and is considered an environmentalist. And she took this kind of turn in this book where she gets very excited about the fact that technology, again, this idea that technology is going to pull us out at the last minute. So this is a review of her book, The Human Age, from the New York Times, from the Sunday Book Review. This is written by Bob Nixon. And he says, this is from the article by Bob Nixon. There is, however, a four-ton mastodon in the living room that Ackerman tiptoes around. The 21st century rise of the Anthropocene as a unitary species story coincides with a trend toward rising inequity between the haves and the never-will-haves. In America, we call the Second Gilded Age, but in nations as diverse as China, Ireland, India, Spain, and Nigeria, the idea of human is also fracturing economically. In 2013, the world's 85 wealthiest individuals, you all know this, you could even say this along with us, had a net worth equal to our planet's 3.5 billion poorest people. Since 1751, a mere 90 corporations, primarily oil and coal companies, have generated two-thirds of humanity's CO2 emissions. That's a serious concentration of earth-altering power. So when Ackerman uncritically quotes the futurist Roy Kurzweil's prediction that by the 2030s we'll be putting millions of nanobots inside our bodies to augment our immune system to basically wipe out disease, this reader was prompted to ask, pray tell, which we would that be? So it's a similar argument. He says the number of forcefully displaced people has topped 51 million people, and he addresses this issue of Ackerman focusing on the interplay between technology, design, and evolution. But what of the decisive role played by forms of governance? In the plutocratic milieu of the 21st century, how do we ensure that innovations aren't by the few for the few, and that they don't compound the trend toward islands of extreme affluence barricaded against the vulnerable multitudes? Technology's emergence is no guarantee that its benefits will trickle down to humanity at large. And at the end he says, is it ethical that the super rich capture even more resources, the poor who have contributed least to our planet's undoing are forced to bear the brunt of the chaotic effects, and to say nothing of the other creatures. So she got spanked by some critics for her book. But then there is a book that is, I think, a more even-handed book called The Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Colbert, and that's reviewed by Casper Henderson. I don't know where this came from. Oh, it's The Guardian. It's Guardian Book Review. And he likes the book. And I just want to read his quote from her at the end of the review, because I think it's chilling. Colbert writes, "We are deciding without quite meaning to which evolutionary pathways remain open and which don't. I don't know about you, but I don't recall being involved in that decision. Indeed, it seems that some of the most important decisions are being taken by those individuals who are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to keep people in the dark about climate change and who are blocking moves to a green economy. We need to decide otherwise." So, haven't read her book. I did talk to her on the phone. She's in Europe, and so it's very hard for us to get her on the phone to interview her. But I was impressed.
I want to comment on this framing of who is this we you're talking about in the context of how even that discussion is focusing on one aspect and perhaps taking our attention away from yet another more fundamental and more important. The review I mentioned of that same book by Elizabeth Colbert by Al Gore has in it a discussion of all the things that could be better, need to be better, concluding with how, and this is the quote, "the choices we're making in industry, energy policy, agriculture, forestry, and politics." Again, the universal we humans, but of course, we aren't. So this isn't just a matter of the distribution of the costs and benefits of those decisions. It's who's making those decisions. And it's not even principally about what we ordinarily conceive of as political institutions, because political institutions aren't making those decisions. Those are investment decisions, and those are being made in, by and large, corporate boardrooms, but in privately held companies, it's a corporate form, but it's being made by a handful of people. The picture that we are being given is there's a problem here with how this all gets decided without any clear solution. Yeah, and as an example of that, of how things get directed and misdirected, there was a recent article in the San Francisco Chronicle about a group of environmentalists who have banded together in order to help preserve, keep the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant in operation, because climate change is such an important issue that we have to throw all other considerations aside and preserve nuclear power. Now, it isn't just that these guys are kind of cranks.
One of them is Stuart Brand.
Well, yeah, Stuart Brand, who is kind of crank, but and always has been. But one of the people they have on board with him is James Hansen, one of the leading lights of climate change scientists, one of the first people to raise his voice about it. Another supporter of nuclear power on greenhouse gas emission grounds, climate change grounds, is
Al Gore is one of them.
Well, Al Gore is certainly one of them.
Yeah.
And James Lovelock, who is the originator of the Gaia concept.
Oh, dear.
He thinks nuclear power is absolutely essential. Otherwise, we're going to kill the planet, blah, 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 blah. So, sorry for saying blah, 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 blah. That's poor diction.
Did you have more to say about that? Because I don't know if people need to be reminded why nuclear power is not an option here. Let's start with Diablo Canyon, which is a very old and decrepit and broken down power plant that's kind of waiting to blow. The technology is really old, and it is just completely surrounded by earthquake faults that nobody looked at before they built it. And it's not really fixable. If you want to find out more about the anti-nuclear power movement and the problems with Diablo Canyon, EON, Ecological Options Network, has a YouTube channel, and they have numerous, if you plug in Diablo Canyon, there'll be plenty of short YouTubes that you can watch for those of you who like to spend that much time online. You can watch some of these, but the other problem is that there's no place to put nuclear waste. There's the nuclear power plants are a support system for nuclear weapons, and nobody's talking about Fukushima. Of course, we will soon talk about it because it's still going on. Chernobyl, what we know about Chernobyl is that the IQ of those children has never recovered, that it was a lost generation, and we don't know yet the ramifications of what's going to happen in Japan, but we can pretty much predict, and the drift all over the world and the marine mammals and on, but there's no place to put away the waste. There's nothing, it doesn't get thrown away. It continues to exist, and there are meltdowns now happening fairly regularly, and when they do, it's pretty close to the end of times. So that's what I think. Yes. Shall we get on to this?
So having kind of, so that you don't think that we just made all this negative stuff up. We're just carping about it.
We are just carping about it.
We aren't just carping about it. We are carping about it, but with good reason. The Anthropocene Review published about a year before this other one we've been discussing, published an article by two, I am assuming they are Marxists, Swedish researchers, geologists. The title of the article is The Geology of Mankind, A Critique of the Anthropocene Narrative. What these folks do is, to summarize, is evaluate how the concept has developed and why it is misbegotten. They analyze it as having developed out of the earth sciences, and because of that has failed utterly to take into consideration issues around an analysis of culture and power. So that, for example, one of the leading causes attributed to the rise of greenhouse gases, they focus on climate change as the quintessential example of the anthropogenic change in the geologic record. So they tend to focus on that science, but nevertheless, discuss how in that ideology, the emergence or the appearance on the scene of the steam engine, this great fossil fuel burning mechanism, issued in anthropogenic change, without actually analyzing what the emergence, what that meant, what the appearance of the steam engine meant, and how it actually came about. Well, it didn't fall from the sky, and it didn't, you know, a pattern for building nests that appears in all bird species or in all birds of a species. It happened in a particular place, in a particular time, based on the decisions of particular and very narrowly defined interests of people. So the appearance of the steam engine is actually was predicated on a number of both physical and social systems, including slavery, a depopulated or an underpopulated new world, the global cotton trade, and the British structure of factory and mining based on wage labor, commodity labor. And those are all, and the decisions to both invent the steam engine and put it into practice were made, as I mentioned before, as investment decisions, not food gathering decisions. And the point here is that the decisions were made by a specific class of people, the capitalist class. And that has prompted at least one commentator on this issue to say that perhaps it shouldn't be the Anthropocene, maybe it should be the Econocene.
Yeah, I think so.
Or what are some of the other pithy ones that he comes up with? But anyway, that point to not the supposedly technical aspects of what human beings have done, but the social forces that come together to cause these things to happen. So that, for example, something that I've mentioned before, the technologies that we have available to us that are wreaking havoc are, first of all, not evenly distributed, as is pointed out, as we've pointed out in kind of indirect ways, but not everyone in the world is pumping out greenhouse gases. In fact, there's an estimate of tens of millions of people.
I have the estimate here. What's interesting, and this is that because everyone blames the developing world is, but in fact, it says in the early 21st century, the poorest 45% of the human population accounted for 7% of emissions, while the richest 7% produced 50%, a single average citizen of Ethiopia, Chad, Afghanistan, Mali, Cambodia, or Burundi are these basic facts are, anyway, you get the idea, but that it's not true that this kind of mythology that the developing world is burning coal and that's the problem and they're, you know, that it's not, in other words, the wrong things are being cited.
Yeah, they estimate that something like one out of six people on the face of the earth is excluded from greenhouse gas emissions, generating greenhouse gases. Let's pound this even more. One of the very popular things to do...
Let me just say that this is your own health and fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, and we're talking about the Anthropocene theory, and we're critiquing it. Go ahead.
So more broadly, one of the things that gets trotted out is particularly in very often in terms of energy consumption is that per capita energy consumption is problematic, so that population growth is a problem. Yet in areas where population is growing most rapidly, the consumption of the production of CO2 of carbon dioxide decreases at a much slower rate for large population growth areas, and vice versa for slow population growth areas, that CO2 emissions increase much more dramatically.
This is a game-changing article, and were we able to put a link to it on?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, because people should read this article from start to finish. It's very good.
The concept here is that CO2 emissions or greenhouse gas emissions are unequally distributed. Now that's based on technologies being put into place that produced CO2, and how are those decisions made? They're made as investment decisions. What are the technologies that are developed? For instance, fracking. Why did fracking get implemented? Very poisonous technology. Got implemented because oil prices became high, and investors saw an opportunity and flooded the market with fracking technologies, causing a glut in fossil fuels, the price of oil has dropped like a rock, and those industries, despite catastrophic environmental effects, are going out of business. So the problem here, to put it as simply as possible, is our actions collectively as human beings have consequences, and the decisions that are made that produce those consequences are, like the effects, not evenly distributed. And in fact, they're held in the hands of a very few people.
I have some points to make, too, when you're ready.
The issue here is that the things that are happening are sociogenic, not anthropogenic. They're what happens as a consequence of actions people take as social beings, not as biological beings. And there's the confusion. And there's why the earth scientists and the natural scientists who are evaluating this are blind to that issue.
Yeah, in fact, they say, this is a quote, many a social scientist and humanist has swallowed it lock, stock, and barrel, oblivious to its antisocial tendencies, attracted by the idea of the anthropos as center and master of the universe, which speaks to a certain humanistic sensibility. And they go on to talk about the fact that, unlike in the crisis of capitalism, there are no lifeboats here for the rich and the privileged, in the sense that you look at the drought in Australia, the recent fires in wealthy neighborhoods here in California, et cetera, et cetera. But this is a flawed argument, and it still comes down to the fact that the areas that have been most blighted are places where there's poverty, where people are not being protected, like in Sandy Hook and Katrina and New Orleans and in Haiti and Manhattan, areas in Manhattan, Bangladesh and the Netherlands. It goes on and on. So there will be lifeboats for the rich and privileged. But if this continues, if the climate change represents a kind of apocalypse, then it may not be universal, but uneven and combined. So the species is not so much as an abstraction as the end of the line as at the source. But I think some of the most important things that they say here is they're calling for a dismantling of the fossil fuel economy. They're suggesting that this type of theory being put forward is paralyzing people from social action, and that the biggest problem is that the theoretical framework, which also happens to not be which happens to be not only analytically defective but also inimical to action, it's paralyzing people from feeling that they can take action. politically.
And again, that is because it's being framed as a problem of our species and not as a problem of our social system that lends itself to mystification. It's a problem of human beings. So when you read an article about this and you read that we are causing this or we are causing that, that is mystification. Because we aren't. Some people in corporate boardrooms are causing this because they are making decisions. And this isn't about you need to ride a bicycle more often and get rid of cars because we have to do that. Well, we may not have an option because we have to get to work.
Yeah, it goes back to seizing the means of production again, some more.
And that is and to get back to the technosphere and the centrality of that that concept to the rise of the Anthropocene and the potential for a sixth mass extinction, the decisions over what technologies get developed and get implemented are not decisions that you and I make. We don't make those decisions. They are made elsewhere by those in power in the social system, and I don't mean elected officials.
So what we're both calling for here is to allow yourself to have an experience of biophilia, love of nature, and really connect with nature more and more, because the more that you partake of technology that's importing a homogenous worldview to people all over the world and taking them away from their place in the world, the more of a problem we have and more we can be manipulated. So we're calling for obviously using biomimic technologies that have that are held up to the precautionary principle and that work by nature's rules, and that we have that we have the choice and not all these other people, so don't be mystified.
Live simply. Don't poison other creatures.
Yeah, first do no harm, etc. So it is possible to do, and it isn't just about changing your light bulbs, as we've said so much. Thank you so much for listening. You've been listening to a show about the Anthropocene. We've been critiquing the Anthropocene theory. I want to remind you that you can visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier extended access to our archive shows with our library card feature. And you can get a free stream of this week's show every week. You additionally can find any postings or links at our website, for instance, of this article, this critique article. So all of it's at yourownhealthandfitness.org, and if you need to get in touch with us, please do that by email. It's admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.